You're listening to Spartan Up Podcast. We're going to interview somebody every week from all over the world and see what they did in their life to become successful, no matter how they defined it.
Hey, here we are at SpartanUpPodcast.com. We're in the barn, in the Amy Barn in Pittsfield, Vermont. I'm surrounded by greatness. I have Colonel Tim Nye.
Hello.
I have Joe Desena.
Haru.
I have Sephra.
Chirp, chirp.
And I have Marion behind the camera. You don't get to see Marion, but we do, and it's quite a sight. But more importantly...
A beautiful one.
More importantly, she makes us look good. She puts this whole thing together, so that's the five of us. And but this episode, unbelievable. So Kareem Jowd, his story starts in Lebanon. Obviously, you're going to hear the story. It's not going to tell much about it, but we've got kidnapping, we've got torture, we've got international success, we've got starting again.
The show of Iran.
Yeah, yeah. We bring Iran in. This is an unbelievable story, but the thing that really got me about this story is every time you think you've heard the end of it, and you think it's the most incredible story you've ever heard, it starts again. Like, just another thing happens to this guy.
We are here in Los Angeles at Spartan Up, the podcast. Is it SpartanUpPodcast.com? It's SpartanUpPodcast.com for you, those of you that don't know. I'm with Kareem. Is that how you pronounce it? Jowdy?
Kareem Jowdy.
And you're from Lebanon originally.
Correct.
Pretty calm place.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful place. But it was a pretty rough and tumble place, hard to get out of. How did you get out of Lebanon, and when did you get out of Lebanon?
I was kidnapped in Lebanon in 1976. I stayed in
You were kidnapped?
Kidnapped. And I stayed in capture for 92 hours. I was beaten by seven different groups, and luckily I went out of Lebanon. And if you need to know the details.
Let's go back for a second. So you were kidnapped in 72. How old were you?
76.
76. How old were you?
36 years.
Why were you kidnapped?
Because I was rich and famous. And I was a Christian against the war, rich and famous. And I was kidnapped not by the Lebanese, by the Syrian and the Palestinian in Lebanon.
And what did you do that you were rich and famous? What was your business back then?
I made my first million by age 26 by buying and fixing up distressed properties and businesses.
In Lebanon. So anybody watching this wouldn't realize that Lebanon was even a place where you would be able to buy and sell property. Yeah. But back then it was a pretty amazing place.
Lebanon was really the Swiss of the Middle East, the Paris of the Middle East, the Amsterdam of the Middle East. We had everything, really. It was a beautiful, it was the oldest, still oldest democracy in the whole region. So we had beautiful life, and that's what happened. Our neighbor was so jealous that elected to Syria, and before that Abdel Nasser and so on, they elected to destroy us.
So you're 26. What kind of household did you grow up? Were your parents wealthy?
No. We were decent. We were not like wealthy, but we were not poor. I come from a large family. I am number seven of eight children. My father died. I was 5 years old, and I had to work my way up since I was nine. So I paid for all my studies.
And your brothers and sisters, same thing?
Yeah, my oldest brother was 20 years older than me. When my father died, he was in real estate construction. He and my uncle took over my father's business. And here is the irony. I was going to school and going to work. 9 years old, I was pushing wheelbarrows of cement and sands and so on. Carrying wood up ladder. And I was, tired, young. Sometimes I used to fall, slip and fall. And my uncle, one of those big guys, used to say, "Get up, you sissy. Those books that you are carrying all the time are making you a sissy. Forget them and learn to be a man, a real man." I mean,
all right. All right.
And here's the irony. By age 23, my uncle and my brother were both working for me.
And then you start to buy properties yourself? At what age?
Yeah. The first property I bought was me 15.
And then you had the ability to do construction because you came from that family.
I never did construction. My wife calls me her unhandy husband.
Right.
I never did anything by my hand. I always use other people.
Right. And then, so you started to then renovate property, started to do well. And then were there other kidnappings going on at that point in 76?
No, the kidnapping started in 75, really. And very few people were kidnapped 75, 76, were ever released and heard of. I was very lucky to have been released. And if you want how I was released, I can tell you.
Yeah, yeah, I want to find out. So you get kidnapped, you're making money, and you're held for 92 hours.
I was kidnapped and tortured. I went through 7 interrogations. Each group of interrogators had its own way of torturing me. Some of them, to give you an idea, some of them hang me upside down and whip me until I bled profusely. Right. Others put electric shock on a stair like this, electric shock. Some had slap, punch, kick me and stomp their feet on my body. Others put sharp instrument on my nose, on my ears, on my neck, on my shoulder.
And what was their goal?
Trying to find where is my money and most important, what I know about the Christian, because I'm a Christian and they are Syrian against them. Where is the arms and where are who getting the money and fund and so on. I was never involved in any war. Actually, I was against the war and kept telling people, this is not our war. We should not get involved.
And you and your answers to these guys as they were torturing you?
All my life, the best way is to tell the truth, what you know.
Right. And so how did you escape?
One of my employees, at that time, I had 1,265 employees in Lebanon. One of my employees used to be one of those lazy but nice guy. Used to come to me and say, boss, my daughter is sick, I need some milk. Or my wife had to go to the doctor. I used to give him, at that time,
help out.
$50, $20, whatever it is, he requested. That was what he requested. He asked in a nice way, and I never felt threatened by him because, you know, he's a nice guy, but, you know. And when I was kidnapped, getting from one interrogation to another, after 7 interrogations, I was going to the 8th interrogation. Again, during that time, I didn't see anything. Never took off my, even during the night, never slept actually. I have the.
Over your eyes?
My eyes have.
Closed.
And my hand behind me. The only time that is my hand when I had to go to the bathroom. But of course, I never ate anything or slept all the time, just water. So when going to the 8th, I heard his voice. His name is Hasib.
The guy you had been helping?
Yeah.
Right.
He's Palestinian. So he asked me, he said, no, not to my boss. That's what I heard him saying.
Right.
I said, Hasib, is it you? He said, yes. He said, can you help me? He said, what I can do to help you? So I gave him 3 names, let them know, because nobody knew I was there.
Right.
2 hours later, they told me that I was lucky they didn't find anything on me. They have ordered to release me. But this is 3 conditions. I had to sign everything I owned in Lebanon to them. I have to leave Lebanon immediately and not talk about it. So they put me on the first plane out of Beirut with only the dirty clothes and blood stain.
From the interrogation?
Yeah, and put me on the first plane. They took everything. They didn't even let me take my address book. We didn't have phone like now here. My address book, nothing. Not clothes, anything. Just a passport, the American Express, and the dirty clothes. And they kept the American Express because I had to pay the airline ticket.
Right.
So I paid the airline ticket with American Express. As soon as I stepped on the plane, I collapsed. I woke up in a hospital near Geneva with tube all over my body.
Wow. And your family didn't know what happened?
Nobody knew.
Right.
I hope you're not sitting still while you listen. If you are, you better get a burpee break in.
All right, so you're in Geneva. You've got tubes all over you. Now what? Your family doesn't know where you are.
I was on the hallway of the hospital 4-5 days after the hospital, and I saw the Shah brother of Iran and his nephew, who were my friends.
In the hospital in Geneva?
Passing in the hospital, the sister of the Shah was at the hospital. Not the same wing, but the same hospital. So we saw each other, we hugged, see, in the Middle East we hugged each other. And they told me they are worried about me. They tried to reach me. I said, you have reason to worry. And I told them what happens. So they told me I had to come, they invited me to come with them to Iran.
To Iran.
once I feel better and once the sister feels better.
Right.
A few days later, we went to Iran. Now, when I was in Lebanon, I had 1,265 employees. I also had 3 offices in Europe.
How many businesses were that size at that? Was that
At that time, in 1976, I had 12 companies. I had office in Marbella, Spain, office in London, in Paris, and south of France, a town called San Rafael. They did not know anything about my Europe
businesses.
They took everything I had in Lebanon, where I had 1,265 employees.
But how, that was a pretty big business for 76. There weren't many businesses that size.
No, I was, I was important for them. I was an important person. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I was involved in the community and many philanthropy, education. I was instrumental in starting a vocation school in Lebanon to teach young people how to do, how to create jobs, how to train for computer, for mechanics, for carpenter, whatever it is, learn a trade rather than just be on the street. Also in June 76, because of the hardship I went through to get my education, I started a foundation to help children who cannot pay to go to school on my account. And in November of that year, in memory of my father died because he had an accident and did not get the proper medical attention. In his memory, I started another foundation. This is the year I made first million. I started a foundation to provide primary health care to
people that needed it.
Families. Yeah. We used to give about. We started with 600. At one time, we were 1,500 family every year. Not person, family, primary health care. That created a lot of, 26 years young man doing all this. That's big business.
It's a big, big deal. Yeah. But you're in Geneva. You just leave Geneva. Now you're in Iran.
Iran. They exposed me to everything happening in Iran, what's going on the board, exposed me to what's going to happen, introduced me to who is who, and asked me if I want to do something in Iran. So I find the opportunity so compelling that I decided to go to Europe, sell my operation in Europe, come back to Iran. In Iran, in 1978, I had 750 people.
But at that point, do you go back to Lebanon at
all?
No. Right. You're done.
I didn't go to Lebanon till after 3 years ago, 36 years later.
Wow.
So
you sell everything in Europe. Now you're in Iran.
Now I'm in Iran. And
what year is this?
76.
Okay.
Summer 76.
Yeah.
Summer 78, I had in Iran 715 employees. I built in the middle of Iran a huge lake. And that summer, the Shah of Iran invited many presidents from all over the world. And they came to my place and had a water show in the middle of Tehran. I get people from Florida, from south of France, and from Lebanon. And we had a fabulous show in the middle of Tehran. That was in August 1978. The Shah was forced to leave by the end of the year, or before the end of the year. I didn't want to leave. I'm not
you had a
in
lake.
Politics.
You had a lake.
Not lake. I had construction. Right. I'm doing construction in Iran. I didn't do any business consulting there, but right. I was in construction. Who's going to bother me? Didn't work. Somebody with money, somebody rich, somebody with brain, and Christian.
Right.
With a revolutionary guard doesn't work.
Right.
So one night I was having...
Were you considering at this point changing your religion?
No. I'm not very...
Religious?
Religious. I don't believe in religions. My religion has been for over 40 years now to help at least one person a day.
Right.
And has never failed.
That's a good policy.
This is my religion, so it doesn't matter. So. Right. And I do apartment building, I do shopping center, I do investment. My policy for... by criteria, doesn't matter what color, race, or gender you are, can you pay your rent? Would you take care of your property? The property? Would you not create noise to disturb other people? That's my criteria. So, and I spent till now about 20, 22 hours a week and non-profit. So this is my religion, helping other people.
Right.
And I think whoever is up there, that's what he wants us to do.
Yeah, I agree. So, you leave Iran at that point?
No, I was still in Iran.
Yeah.
Then I was having dinner at the Hilton Hotel, actually, with two friends. About 9:30, my housekeeper called me to tell me, boss, don't come home, we have visitors. Three people came, destroyed everything, looted everything. I had, about 3 or 4 months earlier, bought a Picasso painting with little nude in it in London for £53,000 at the time.
Wow.
She said, I never saw it. She said they tore it.
They cut it.
They cut it pieces.
Yeah.
While we were there, the Iranian government show us on TV how they capture over 3,300 the rich people, the intelligent people, the chief of staff, the surgeon general, the head of government, people from the army, anybody with brain or money,
they
capture them, judge them, and shoot them. We were watching them being shot on TV. I'm talking to you, my hair standing up.
And you're not home because you're getting this phone call. Now you're watching TV.
I was on TV in the Hilton Hotel, the Hilton Bar. About 1:15, 1:20 in the morning, she calls me to tell me what happened. That night, I did not dare go home. I didn't dare stay at the hotel because now I am target. What I am target for, I don't know, but I'm target.
Right.
So I roam the streets. 7 o'clock in the morning, I went to the ambassador house. Lebanese ambassador was a friend of mine, was closed.
The Lebanese embassy.
Ambassador house.
Okay.
Then I went to the embassy, closed. The bank closed. The airport closed. My attorney will not respond. I had three attorneys, none of them responded. So I look and I said, wait a minute, I am in Tehran. I have to be out of here. How can I get out of here?
Right.
We say necessity is the mother of invention. When Khomeini came to power, he ordered every female, 10 years or older, to wear a chador, a black robe that covered all your body from head to toes with slight opening for the eyes.
You got one?
I bought chador.
Nice.
Get a train, because I had to go for where I go from Tehran. I can go through Russia, through Afghanistan, through Turkey. Turkey is the easiest way to have the rugged mountain. I don't know anybody there. But if I go to Abadan or Ahwaz, from there I can go to Bahrain. I have friends in Bahrain. Or to Iraq, I have friends in Bahrain. But to go there, I had to go through the city of Qom, where is the headquarters of Khomeini. Khomeini was a supreme leader of Iran.
Yeah.
That's what this idea of having a chador, wearing a chador, go through the area. So I went through several cities to arrive there. It took me 14 days and 17 hours. Not to mention that I never dared close my eyes during that time more than 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I went through train, buses, I rode mules, donkeys, bicycle, and walking, and lot of walking. Arrived to Abadan, I have a friend there. I went knock his house, will not open the door. And I screamed, called him twice. His wife, I have a voice nobody forget. So she said, no, this is Karim, this is Karim. So his name is Ali. He opened the door, grabbed me, and threw me on the floor. You don't want anybody to see. What's going on, guys? I'm not criminal. I didn't do anything. I was building. Anyhow, he called the airport. And he took me to the airport. There's one plane going from there to Bahrain. At the airport, they searched me. I had about close to $7,000 at that time. I had to negotiate my way with them to keep with me $17. So when I arrive, wherever I arrive, I have to pay the taxi till I find something.
And you at this point, did you have money in other places?
No, that's it.
That was it?
That's it.
Even after the first experience with Lebanon, you weren't thinking?
I still had Europe. But
right.
After Europe, I sold Europe, went to Tehran. Right. Now, leaving Iran, I had $17.
Right.
And I had to pay the airline ticket from Abadan, which is Iran, to Bahrain, Bahrain to Paris, arrive here in at the Los Angeles airport. I want to come here because I want to get further away.
You're tired. I don't blame you. You're looking for a new planet.
Yeah. So I came here. I landed at the airport, $17, and my American.
What year was that?
It was February 79.
February 79.
It was. I remember.
No family here.
No. I remember. It was rainy, cold February evening. I went to a motel, and okay, of course, American Express. Now I own the balance of American Express from the trip too.
Right, and you have $17.
$17.
That's a great story, and so now you're in Los Angeles. Let's just keep going. What happens in Los Angeles?
Okay, I started looking at what can I do. I thought the best way is real estate. This is my experience. I had a lot of experience in real estate, so. I went to talk to, first I talked to everybody, what I want to do. Nobody knew I don't have money. Nobody knows where I come from. Right. But I talked to everybody, it was my broken English, to everybody what I was planning to do.
Buy houses. How old are you at this point? 30 something?
40.
40, okay.
Yeah, I'm born in 39, so
right.
October 8th, 39, so.
All right. So you talk to everybody.
So guys, I'm finished.
It's a great story.
Yeah, but it's not easy. Well, even now, after 40 years, I'm still almost 40 years. Anyhow, 35 years. So, cut it briefly. I made offer in every house on the market. And half a dozen houses.
What, $17?
$17. And several houses were not on the market. You see, here is, I don't know if you know anything about real estate. Today it's easy. You go on the internet, you find everything else. At the time, I used to take a bike, rent a bike, or walk, see the houses which need some repairs and so on, get 7, 8, 10 houses, go down by bus, 3 buses to go downtown to look at the record to see who owned those houses, right. And come back, call them, talk to them, write to them, and so on. During this process, because talking to everybody, one of the lawyers was very impressed. He said, I will invest with you. Two of the real estate agents I work with, they gave up too early on me. They said, you are not realistic. What you're trying to offer on those houses
is
not
realistic. Yeah.
The third real estate agent was also very impressed. So he invested $10,000. My lawyer, well, attorney at the time, $10,000. And my lawyer brought me a friend, $10,000. $30,000. We bought the first house in Mar Vista on Inglewood Boulevard between Venice and Washington. $30,000. Fix it up, get loan to fix it up, and they sign on the loan, not me, I don't have anything to sign for. Within 3 months, sold it, bought 3 houses with the profit.
Nice.
And the rest is history.
And just kept going. And so now you have a lot of real estate? And
yes, I own real estate. We have activities now in presence, if you like, in 7 states, but currently I'm finding the best opportunity in Southern California, Phoenix, and Las Vegas.
And mostly residential homes, or
I would say no, mostly apartment building.
Okay.
I went to apartment building within less than 6 months, actually.
You started to do apartment buildings,
yeah.
Right? Six months after that first house,
yes.
Right?
Now I would say 80% of our business are apartment, and 20% are some industrial, some office, shopping center. But for example, we have 3 buildings. One of them a building where we have. All doctors. All the doctors are my tenants and my investor. I do partnership.
Nice.
This is how. So
I
have building where I have law firm and 3 other tenants. They are all my partner and my tenants. But most of them are really apartment building or shopping center.
In 3 states. And it's a pretty big business now?
Decent.
Yeah.
It was very big till 81 when I thought I want to retire. And I could not retire, so I start lecturing at USC, UCLA.
Oh, wow.
And I have been doing seminar at the Lux Hotel now for 19 years in February, in April. Plus, every year I have a whole day seminar, teach people how to do partnership, how to raise money, how to form partnership, how to get capital.
How to escape countries, how to work your way out of being terrorized.
No, that I don't.
How to escape. So Spartan, I don't know how much you know about Spartan, but we have 4 million Spartans out there, mm-hmm. And they come out and do these races. And the races are nothing compared to what you had to do. And in doing those races, it transforms the people because they're used to regular cushy lives where they have air conditioning and heating and everything is perfect. And now they're out in the mud and the barbed wire and the fire, and they get re-energized and they realize, wow, I could do more than I thought I could do. Do you think those experiences you just described, even though upsetting and nearly fatal, is what made you successful? I mean, you were already successful.
I was successful before. I think what made me successful is the desire when I was very young. It's in me, I don't know, it's in me you created, but I remember the old people in the village used to admire me and used to make me as an example to their children, be like him. And when I was a kid, I didn't spend much time with kids. Most of my time was with adults.
Yeah.
I thought I could learn from adults much more.
That's funny.
And let's face it, I didn't have much time to play. I was really either studying or working.
Right. You wanted to get ahead. Where do you get that desire from? How do we teach that desire?
This year, I'm trying to remember where. When my father had the accident, he was in bed. And I used to, very close to him, we spent hours talking about all kind of things. I think this is where it came from, most likely. And I have support of my mother. But my father, one thing I remember clearly, one day we were talking about the war. That was, 45. War is over. And I said to Dad, you said the war is over. How come there still being innocent people being killed? He hugged me and told me, Sonny, in the history of man, there never been justice in the world. And there will never ever be. But what you and I can do is to help reduce other people's suffering and not to add to his suffering.
Right.
In that word, I'm trying to translate from Lebanese to America.
Yeah.
In that word. And I think that's what most influenced me what I'm doing. To be able to start a foundation at age 26, two foundations, right. I had to make money. How can I make money?
Right. Focus on making money, then you can help others.
Yeah.
It's a great story.
Helping, making money the honest way, that's important.
Yeah. All this adversity you faced, would you say it created a positive outcome for you? It changed you in a positive way?
Yes. Nothing bothered me anymore. And I teach my daughter, I have a daughter 22 years old, my son, my wife, everybody around me, it's not what happened to you that matter, it's how to react to it and what you do with it. I did not invent this phrase, somebody before me.
Yeah.
But this is what my philosophy has been before even I came to this country.
We're all going to face adversity.
We are going to face. Actually, I have a book on real estate. I was writing three books. One of them was
How to Escape from Kidnapping.
The Gift of Adversity.
The Gift?
The Gift of Adversity.
Oh.
How to face and overcome adversity.
It's a gift.
It's a gift. And this is for me, when I finish that book, I don't know how long, it's going to take a long time, because the first book took me 5 years, is it tell you how small things like this or big things will make you a different person, give you resilience. You have two choices. Many of my friends who were kidnapped, if they were released, they took their off life, took their own life, and so on. I kept going. So you have two choices. And I tell them when I spoke about adversity, I said, you have two choices. You can sit in a corner and whine, and you can go on with your life.
All right, what a remarkable story, though, kind of just a human spirit.
Yeah.
Of everything that this guy went through. I just kept thinking during this that, maybe he just needed a better travel agent. To go from Lebanon into Iran in the late 70s, just some really bad timing.
Some
stuff. But, clearly he went through a lot, and I don't think we want to focus on all that. But he had, kind of the vision way out there, what it is that he wanted to do and how he wanted to be successful, but how he wanted to impact others, and just how he just kept overcoming challenge after challenge after challenge, not even challenge, setback.
Yeah.
I mean, both physical, financial, and he had some help along the way, and that's important, and we've talked many times about needing that help. Mm-hmm. But this was really, truly a remarkable story. I, much like when we talked about Meb, the Boston Marathon guy, Boston Marathon winner, just being able to overcome personal hardships and just keep going.
Is there a common theme? You've seen many, you've been with many people that have been tortured and things. You've seen that before. Do people typically come out as positive as he did? Or as positive as Meb did in his situation?
Yeah, I may have made a flippant comment to you. I haven't spent a lot of time around
torture. Maybe you were saying
torture,
you want to torture me.
Torture people. So we'll probably cut that. No, listen. I think it's like anything else. I think it's an experience that will either break you or make you, kind of thing, right? I mean, I think that's what the torture is. Much of it is not about breaking you physically, but breaking your spirit. Mm-hmm. Breaking your, mentally and spiritually. And then, can you rebound from that? I would think most people would have a very, very, very hard time doing that. But there's always going to be those people that have, as we've talked many times, that are centered, that have,
hope,
that are anchored, whatever, that will be able to overcome all of that.
I really heard two things that, to me, defined why he kept bouncing back and being successful. A, he had this just extraordinary faith in himself and his ability, and not in a cocky way, but just in the idea of, I've done it before, I can do it again. I can start from zero and get there. And how quickly he was able to do that each time. But his own personal philosophy had very little to do with his own personal success. He talked about what he was proudest of is at 26, he'd started a foundation to help other people, pay for their education, to pay for people's medical. So the driving force in his life was, how can I impact a whole bunch of other people positively? He talked about having 1,200 employees and the fact that he was able to support their families and their businesses. So what did he say that his father taught him, and basically his religion, he said? Because so many of these things were religious situations, he ended up, and he said, I'm not a religious person. My religion has helped one person every day. And by just going back and doing that again and again and again, he was able to just keep moving forward. So that when you talk about hope, I think the fact that he had that true north of, I just need to get up tomorrow morning, help people. And he also talked about the reason he earned money. He wanted to amass fortune because then he could influence people positively with that. Big difference from, so I could buy a bigger boat. Mm.
There is an ancient scholar, Edith Hamilton, who said something like what you were talking about, Corona. He said, when you're faced with adversity and like a shit storm, are we allowed to swear, Marion? Sorry.
The guests are, we aren't.
Many of the guests.
But she says, she talks about fortresses of the spirit, right? So when you're in those dire situations and when you're in situations where there doesn't seem like there is any hope, you have to have like a strong internal belief system and structuring, that keeps you going and knows that you're going to get through this. And
that's that hope. That's
again.
That hope we talk about, right? That's that anchor and the trampoline.
Yeah. No, I mean, it absolutely is. I mean, it could be hope. It could be, again, this guy doesn't profess to be a religious person, but for many people, it's their religion.
Yeah.
It's got to be what you talk about, the true north. Something has to center you. I mean, you've got to have something you can get back to, or keeps you walking that path.
Yeah. And now here he is. He's super successful in his 70s, and he puts on seminars to teach people how to partner. I thought that was really cool. When he said all of his success has been through forging a partnership with somebody. When he came with nothing and started buying real estate within 6 months on apartment buildings, but he said he had to convince somebody to partner with me on that. It was a guy with some money who maybe didn't have his energy, didn't have his vision, and he saw an opportunity. And I think it's really cool that that's what he teaches people, is how do you find somebody to partner with and work with? And you will probably have some talents, but find somebody else you can work with. I thought that was a really, really cool thing. Yeah. And you've talked, and I think in this one you even talked about, don't be afraid to ask for help. There's always somebody who's further down the road that would love to reach back and pull somebody along.
Almost everybody.
Yeah.
And there's always opportunity in the world.
That's, yeah.
I would bet that he's very good at reading people.
Sure.
One, if you're being tortured, and he talked about, seven different groups of people torturing him, the rest of that. But I mean, just again, to find somebody to come as an immigrant, another great immigrant story, to come and find that guy who's got the money and the time to give to him. You've got to be able to pick that guy, select it. There's some skill involved in that as well, right?
Oh, sure.
So,
sure.
No doubt about it.
He's learned somehow to read people.
Yeah.
And that's all part of leadership as well. He's got 1,200 people working for him.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of talents.
Yeah, absolutely. Incredible guy.
Great story.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, one of my favorite podcasts.
Thank you for listening to another epic story of success.
Find show notes, video, and audio from this episode at SpartanUpPodcast.com/051.
Or follow us on Twitter at SpartanUpPod. Spartan Up Podcast is brought to you by Spartan Race.
Sign up for daily workout emails at Spartan.com.